This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Howdy, it's the Texas edition of Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Thanks for hanging out with Jay and I and talking Texas politics, which is always interesting. We've got a grab bag of stuff here this week, Jay. Some pretty eventful things on the horizon here and a couple of scandals. So what's up first?
Well, Brandon, how great is Donald Trump? That's a question that can only be answered by our lieutenant governor. Dan Patrick believes that Donald Trump is the greatest president since the venerated Ronald Reagan. What are your thoughts?
This is interesting. Yeah, he also defended in a radio interview the president's intellect at a time where people were starting to question whether or not the president was mentally fit. I don't know whether or not Trump is as great a president as Reagan. If it were me, I definitely would put Reagan on the second Mount Rushmore just because of the impact he had on the administrative state and the skills that he brought to the presidency. Trump is still a bit of a wild card in my mind. I'll say this. We've done some surveys, a colleague and I at Boise State, and we haven't finished the numbers yet. But what we find so far is that when we ask people questions about Trump, he literally ranks paces behind James Buchanan. If you are lower than James Buchanan, I think objectively you're not in the category of greatest. So, and this also includes scandal-ridden presidents as well.
Sure.
Presidents who died within, you know, months of being elected. So, objectively, it's not so clear he's right.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, Donald Trump's basically had a cup of coffee in the White House.
Right.
That's essentially the duration of time he's been there. Obviously, the lieutenant governor was exercising a wee bit of hyperbole in his comment, but I think it speaks to a larger question as to for him to demonstrate that he is, in fact, firmly entrenched and camped with President Trump and is going to do what he can to defend him.
And politically, for I think Dan Patrick, it's not much of a problem, but it could be a problem for some down-ballot Republicans who are fighting for their lives in these districts. So I don't know that as a party question that Dan Patrick's putting Trump in that category is good for the party, but clearly he doesn't feel he's vulnerable in that way at all.
Well, Brandon, we are fast approaching January 15th, which is also the day we celebrate the birth and life of Martin Luther King Jr. In many communities all around the country, there are parades honoring him. The city of Arlington decided to make the honorary chair of the parade our very own Governor Greg Abbott, and it's created a little bit of controversy.
Yeah, some local minority leaders have criticized his involvement. They've suggested that the governor has not stood for the ideals of Martin Luther King Jr. And has actively stood against these ideals and appointed to things like voter ID as being part of it. You hate to see these kinds of things politicized, but it's clear that that's the world we live in, and it's difficult to be able to disaggregate the politics of one thing from the other.
Yeah, you know, I think we've talked about this before, and it's everything from, you know, whether your sports team should visit the White House,
yeah,
you know, whether individuals should be, you know, attend events with the president or the governor, et cetera. I think we have gotten to the point now where we can't separate the office and the prestige and the honor that the office bestows with the current occupant in that office.
Well, Jay, there's more controversy. It turns out that a commissioner for the Texas Department of Transportation has gotten into some hot water with respect to double billing. So what's happening here?
Yes, that's right, Brandon. TxDOT Commissioner Victor Vandergriff, who also was a longtime lobbyist for the American Automobile Dealers Association, decided to take on a new client, Berkshire Hathaway, the Motor Group, and lobby on their behalf in Austin. Decided to use funds from the Transportation Commission position to fund his trips to Austin, where he was actually lobbying.
Yeah, this, like so many things in Texas government, blurs the lines between their official role and some of their full-time jobs or paid consulting. I think that this is not the end of this story. There have been tremendous problems with respect to the legislature and their private dealings and how they deal with public issues. And this is also true for agencies. So there are agency problems here that have to be dealt with beyond this that I think need to be cleaned up. And the legislature needs to take a look at these things clearly in the next session.
Well, I think this sort of speaks to a larger point, though. I mean, these agencies are part of the executive branch of Texas state government. Mm-hmm. They're directly under or indirectly under the governor's office. The governor, I think, has done a very poor job, at least thus far, in the oversight elements of his office. And I think that's been the issue. We've seen this in agency after agency. The ethics and the oversight element, I think, has been lost. And it's something that in some ways sort of led to a call in the last session by the legislature to really rein in some of the ethical questions about who gets to be on these boards, who gets to be on these commissions. And should the governor have sort of a free-for-all in terms of who he wants to appoint?
Yeah, and that's, I think, the last big point for the week, and there are little nuggets here, is that the governor has backed some individuals who had run afoul of him and what he considered to be an executive providence. So this most recent incarnation is that the governor has endorsed challenger Mays Middleton over Representative Wayne Faircloth from Dickinson. This is a kind of a classic matchup of establishment conservative versus kind of a, you know, newer conservative, a Tea Party conservative. And we've seen this play out in a couple of other dimensions, too. We see it here in Houston with Sarah Davis being challenged by Susanna Ducopol, who has been endorsed by the governor. So this kind of executive tension is playing out in elections. What do you think is going to happen in this? Do you think that this makes the governor look powerful? Do you think that it gives him extra credibility in the next session? Or do you think that this is just kind of political theater?
I think the key issue here with the governor is that he's chosen races where he thinks he can have some level of influence or wants to make a statement. I think what's interesting in both cases, both in the Faircloth-Middleton race and in the Ducopol-Davis race, is that he's picking them based on the incumbent's actions on legislation mm-hmm. that he was unhappy about.
Yeah.
In the case of Faircloth, he supported legislation that dealt directly with the question of ethics and who the governor could and could not appoint. And that struck right at the core of what the governor wanted to try to maintain his control and power. Same thing in the case of Representative Davis. She ran afoul of the governor, was very vocal in her opposition to some of his pet issues. The governor, I think, is trying to exercise some authority, but it looks a little petty and looks very political. These are generally well-regarded, popular members from their respective districts. Faircloth clearly is in a more vulnerable position than Davis.
Yeah.
But I think it speaks to a larger question as of what the governor is trying to do. We've already seen these sort of attacks on local government, local elected officials. We've seen now attacks on members that are sort of dissenting from his view. Governor is certainly trying to exercise authority. The question is kind of how likely he will be to be successful.
Yeah, in an election year, I think the politics he's playing makes sense, right? He's going for more conservative challengers to more moderate members. That's something that plays well with the base. I think, too, in terms of the institutional side of things, that he has attempted to make the governorship stronger. And that's something we see in kind of how he's dealt with line item vetoes in the budget, as well as here him using the party as leverage to get sort of people who might agree with him more, although I'm not sure that they will. So I do see, I think you're right, this kind of shift for the governor now, whether it'll pay off or not, and or whether it'll be in time or not to have effects in the next session. I don't know.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and dive deep into the goings on in this newly charged up Democratic primary for governor.
Well, Jay, we've got primaries coming. We know that the Democrats and Republicans are both going to have a fairly dramatic primary fight, but more so for the Democrats. That's what we're going to talk about today. We've got 9 candidates running for governor. We had 10 last week, but we had one candidate who had a check bounce. So she was
never
unable
never a good sign, right?
Not a good start. So we have 9 candidates running. Many of them were at a candidate forum in San Angelo that was oddly scheduled for the same time as the national championship game in football. So I don't know how many people saw it or listened to it, but we have a race and we have some interaction. So what do we see from that? What do we look forward to in terms of the events to come?
The interesting thing to me with the governor's race is it's in some ways, I think, put a lot of focus on the primary, which is great for the Democrats, because if they didn't have a contested race, we wouldn't even be talking about any of the primaries, because for the vast majority of them are uncontested. So the real question, I think, right now is we've set up this sort of almost de facto Houston versus Dallas battle that seems to be working with Andrew White, the Houstonian, and Lupe Valdez, the sheriff from Dallas County. Valdez, I think, is trying to make a case for a kind of an identity-based Democratic Party, one that sort of looks to the emerging Latino population, is really, I think, counting on great support from women and sort of traditional progressive Democratic interest groups. Andrew White curiously, he's trying to run almost like a general election campaign in a primary.
Yeah.
And you have to give him a lot of credit for it. It's a very difficult thing to do because he's taking positions that are squarely sort of in the center of the electorate, but maybe not in the center of the Democratic Party. And I think that's the real challenge there.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, White and Valdez are the two front runners. There are others who are running. A businessman from San Antonio, Tom Wakely, he called for the establishment of a business income tax. That's going to be a tough order. There was a businessman from Austin named James Jolly Clark who called for a longer school day. So there's a kind of a mixed bag of people who are running. But obviously White and Valdez are the two probably front runners. They're going to raise the most money and be the most visible. Although Valdez joked that people didn't recognize her outside of her wearing her uniform. So I think that's going to be a big problem for her, but also for White. Like, just getting enough attention, getting noticed in 40 days is going to be a bit of a challenge. To me, her issues are slightly different than his. She's talked about infrastructure, healthcare. It's a bit of a grab bag. He's talked more about education. He said he wants to be the education governor. We've heard that before, right? Teacher pay.
Who doesn't want to be the education governor?
Actually, this is a good point. I mean, everybody pretty much says this. But he says this is the biggest issue. I think that is probably the biggest issue the state confronts. I mean, it's like logistically the most important thing and the most expensive thing the state does. Getting Democratic primary voters excited about that, I'm not sure can work. For her, she talks more about like on the ground level things like bridges, roads need to be repaired, healthcare. She's talked about the fake ideas that have been brought up. She accused the Democrats or Republicans of having kind of Wizard of Oz scenario where they bring up, you know, bathrooms and sanctuary cities and voter fraud. She says, yeah, basta, enough, right? Which I think actually, you know, is not only true to her sort of personality, but also I think helps to kind of raise her profile in the Latino community. So I do think that we're going to see some differences here, but not a lot. They both say they want to bring common sense back to Austin. It's just unclear kind of exactly what that means. But I think just from a presentation point of view, White seems to be more polished at this point, a little bit more kind of fleshed out in terms of policy positions than Valdez does. But, you know, for her, at least it's been a couple of weeks that this has been a reality.
White's got some interesting proposals already out there. His plan to fund $5,000 bonus for every teacher
right.
in Texas has actually gotten a little bit of play. There's
Greg Abbott talked about
Though. Yeah, he did. The interesting thing is that White has put a funding source, which is pretty unusual for a candidate. At this stage of the game, we specifically talked about wanting to close an interesting loophole that exists in state law, which allows out-of-state corporations to essentially have a choice whether they are going to pay for the taxes based upon the assessed value or the purchase value, or can they fight it in court. He essentially wants to eliminate that loophole so that they must pay the rate at the assessed value, which would generate about $5 billion in additional dollars that could then flow directly to fund these kind of programs. It's very wonky, but it's actually a very good idea and very detailed. It'll be interesting to see if she kind of tries to match it with other details. As you said, she talked a lot about infrastructure. Traditionally, the governor of Texas, that's not been their purview. Education policy has been. Utility rates have always been a big issue, and taxes have been a huge issue. Property taxes in Texas are very, very high. Democrats don't normally talk about taxes, and so for White to even be talking about that in that discussion, I think is an interesting one. But again, this speaks to me that he's positioning himself for a general election. I would throw this to you, Brandon. The reality is nobody knows really either of them, but there are certain structural advantages for Latino surnamed candidates.
Yeah.
And Lupe Valdez, and you know this better than anyone because you worked on a campaign that had this advantage. Lupe Valdez starts this race at what, 28, 29% if she does nothing?
Yep. Yeah, and those turnout machines are much more pronounced than the ones that would turn out for a White Democrat. I think that White has got a good strategy for a November Democrat, but not maybe for a March Democrat. And I think that's the real difference. He's trying to have it a bit of both ways. I mean, he wants to have this kind of wonkish approach, which I think is really smart. In terms of governing, I think that these things make good sense. He's talked about toll roads, which is going to be a major, I think, problem for him to get crossover Republican support. But he also said in that candidate forum that essentially Texas lives in Trump's prison. So there is a kind of overarching dissatisfaction with the way that the sort of politics in the country has gone. I think that his message, if properly pitched, can be persuasive. But I think that for her, in terms of appealing to a primary audience, is going to be a bit more connective. And so I think you're right that we're going to see that probably more clear. But we have a contested primary. It could get a little bit ugly. Is it the case that this contested primary could lead to hurt feelings?
Yeah, I thought about that too, because I can see both ways. Andrew White might be able to get past this and get into a November election if he can get this to a runoff.
My guess is that it's going to be these two and that there's going to be a runoff just because they'll split the vote a bunch of different ways. And I think it's going to be a barn burner and definitely one to watch. And there's positives to having that energy, but I think that the real question is then how do they come back together? Can they unify the party after this is all said and done, right? When the war is over, how do we reconstruct the party? And I think that's the real question they have to answer.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to tell you what to look for in the next few weeks as this race develops.
Well, Jay, so the Houston Marathon's upcoming, and I know that you're participating, so look for Jay at the finish line. But
staggering across the finish line.
Speaking of marathons, this is a primary, which is going to have, I think, long-term implications, but is really a sprint, right? We've got like 40 days, like you say. It's going to be really close. What do we expect for what's going to happen in the Democratic side of the primary?
Well, I think the first thing to look for is sort of the immediate thing we think about in politics, which is the money race. Andrew White's going to release, I think, some reports coming up in Monday.
Yeah.
And that'll be the first chance we get a chance to look and see who's really supporting him and what kind of support he's getting.
Yeah.
Similar with her, how much money she's transferring over, who were the initial backers for her. Then probably want to look to see who are some of the other big names that are getting involved in this race. If you think about it this way, if you look at the Democratic primary as a group, sort of a coalition party with different slivers of the electorate sort of rallying behind certain candidates, the question I would ask are, where are some of the African-American leaders in the state? They're about 17-18% of the state primary electorate. It's a significant portion. You know, where is Mayor Turner supporting? Is he supporting the hometown person, or is he supporting Lupe Valdez or someone else, or is he staying out? Same thing with Mayor Rawlings in Dallas and Adler in Austin. Where are some of the leadership lining up?
I think that at least in this session, at least in this cycle, we haven't really seen a shyness about endorsing, because we've seen like 17 House candidates endorse Trey Martinez Fisher against his opponent in the primary. We've seen Armando Wally embrace one of the candidates running in CD7. So there's definitely, like, I think, a new world where people are not uncomfortable with backing one candidate or the other. But to me, this is about the future of two-party Texas. The question is, will competitiveness here lead to accountability? And who wins these primaries will largely shape those decisions down the road. So in that sense, it's good to have a competitive primary. There are twice as many Democrats running for offices this year as there were 4 years ago. So the party is in some ways, I think, rebuilt, at least from the base. And so you do see more competitiveness, and competitiveness in elections is always good. That leads to accountability. So how the Democrats want to shape this, who's going to win, what the tone will be, is really going to result, I think, from what we find here at the top of the ticket in the governor's race.
Well, that's a wrap for this week. Remember, we also do a National Politics Episode 2, which you can also download on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Party Politics is recorded at the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Thanks to our super producer, Edel Howland, and thanks to our sound engineer, Todd, the Governor, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.